24-hour surveillance wherever the drones were directed to fly. And, of course, in comparison with Iraq, the Afghan battlefield was much larger and more dispersed. Flynn's first advice to McChrystal was, "We are blind on the battlefield, and we had better move fast." Flynn worked his classified email and phones to call in favors from colleagues scattered worldwide. He tried to speed up the Pentagon's procurement and supply lines. He had an ally in Robert Gates, the defense secretary, who had ordered a crash increase in drone and other ISR production when he arrived at the Pentagon in 2007. Yet it had taken time for manufacturing to catch up with his orders, and 2 years later, supply was still inadequate. Like a manic project manager building a secret television network, Flynn ultimately imported about 175 fixed and mobile aerostat blimps to Afghanistan. He became partial to the smaller aerostats that could be tied to patrolling armored vehicles and toted across the vast stretches of southern Afghanistan, providing over-the-horizon reconnaissance. The blimps were visible, tempting targets for the Taliban and other Afghans with guns. Small rounds from assault rifles generally didn't damage the aerostats severely, but a rocket-propelled grenade could. Once, Flynn's team was visiting Kandahar when an intelligence unit reeled down a blimp from maintenance and found an arrow stuck in its skin. Flynn also created secret flat-screen-filled fusion centers packed with targeting analysts in Kandahar, Mazar-i-Sharif, and Herat. Simultaneously, ISAF and the CIA expanded the number of Omega bases along the Pakistan border to about 8 and linked them to drone and other surveillance and cell phone intercept systems. When Flynn and McChrystal first arrived in June, American forces had perhaps 2 full strike packages for offensive raids against Taliban commanders or units. A strike package was a sizable integrated unit that included not just the men and helicopters to carry out lethal raids or searches, but dedicated helicopter support, artillery units, interpreters, and intelligence. They soon increased the number of strike packages to about 14. Yet as Flynn and his intelligence aides flew about Afghanistan, building out infrastructure to support ramped-up kill-or-capture operations against the Taliban, they also became increasingly disquieted by ISAF's lack of political and social insights about the enemy. Since 2002, for all the captains and Green Berets who had taken tea and chatted about tribes and development with local elders, the ISAF intelligence collection and analysis system remained overwhelmingly focused on tactical events, a shootout here, a bombing there, or reports on the component parts of the latest IED that had blown up. As Flynn put it starkly in a paper he co-authored in 2010, criticizing not only Pentagon intelligence, but the CIA and National Security Agency as well, 8 years into the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. intelligence community is only marginally relevant to the overall strategy. Having focused the overwhelming majority of its collection efforts and analytical brain power on insurgent groups, the vast intelligence apparatus is unable to answer fundamental questions about the environment in which U.S. and allied forces operate and the people they seek to persuade. Ignorant of local economics and landowners, hazy about who the power brokers are and how they might be influenced, incurious about the correlations between various development projects and the levels of cooperation among villagers. U.S. intelligence officers and analysts can do little but shrug in response to high-level decision-makers seeking the knowledge, analysis, and information they need to wage a successful counterinsurgency. It was a stark, impolitic, even shocking summary of the American position in Afghanistan. The paper's boldness was characteristic of Flynn, a man not prone to self-censorship. It raised at least 3 fundamental questions about the Obama administration's incipient war strategy. If kill or capture operations were inadequate by themselves, and if ISAF lacked basic insights into how those raids affected the social and political landscape, why was the United States doubling down on lethal operations? Was ISAF actually capable of acquiring the subtle insights Flynn listed concerning a society as complex and opaque to outsiders as Afghanistan's? And what were the most important insights about the Afghan public's likely reaction to a surge of U.S. forces? Nobody had ever asked them whether they wanted so many ground troops in the first place. It did not require an expeditionary battalion of anthropologists and political scientists to discover much of what was at issue. Daily reading of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal alone would provide any Obama cabinet member a directionally reliable sense of rising Afghan anger over civilian casualties and intrusive night raids, at least in Pashtun areas of the country. Popular disgust at the predatory Afghan government and police, and declining faith that American-led troops could defeat the Taliban. If policymakers discounted journalism, they could read raw field reporting from the State Department, CIA, and DIA that documented the same attitudes. In Zabul, Special Forces raids and casualties brought so many protesters into the streets at one point that the local governor feared public outrage might tip the balance and hand the Pashtun-dominated province to the Taliban. NATO convoys following safety protocols continued to flee the scene when they ran over Afghan pedestrians or crashed into civilian taxis. Their lack of accountability provoked angry Afghan mobs to gather and sack the next foreign vehicle through. The same files documented the growing influence of the Taliban's shadow governments around Afghanistan. Across the South, Taliban commanders ordered commercial Afghan cell phone providers, backed by NATO, to shut down certain cell towers so that the guerrillas could infiltrate for attacks without being tracked by their phone signals. The Taliban destroyed switching stations if the carriers disobeyed. That summer in Helmand, as the Marines settled in, a State Department political officer touring the province described in a classified cable the residue of British occupation in Nuzad, once Helmand's second-largest city, now Fallujah-like, with packs of dogs roaming the streets, dead trees in the fields, and buildings abandoned amid piles of rubble. The officer met with elders and mullahs on the town's outskirts and recorded the local Afghans' advice. They wanted security, strongly preferred Afghan forces to American Marines, noted the absence of any Afghan government presence, and reported on the closure of all local schools, as well as the resilient influence of the Taliban. "We are like rocks here," one man said. "You kick us, the Taliban kick us, no one listens to us." From Tampa, Petraeus commissioned Marine Major General Douglas Stone to study Afghan prisons. In July, as Flynn and McChrystal settled in, Stone produced a 700-page classified report that shocked some of those in the Obama administration who read it. It found that Taliban commanders had effectively taken control of major Afghan prisons and were running sections of the war by cell phones from inside. Hundreds of Taliban broke out of Sarposa prison in Kandahar in the summer of 2008, the first of two mass escapes from that facility. In July 2009, the National Security Council also reviewed intelligence reporting on threat finance, meaning the Taliban's budget. The latest reporting listed the Taliban's key financial sources as fundraising in the Persian Gulf Emirates, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which brought in an estimated $100 million annually, and then drug dealing, protection rackets, local taxation, extortion, and kidnapping. Doug Lute noted to an interagency meeting that the Taliban appeared to be succeeding with very lean operating funds. "We spend $60 billion a year," Lute remarked. "They need $60 million a year." Gates had formally tasked McChrystal to conduct an assessment of the war by the end of August. Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, asked in Jeff Eggers, a Navy SEAL who had completed graduate studies at Oxford University, to join the command team as his strategic advisor. McChrystal also recruited Christopher Kalenda, a West Pointer who had graduate degrees in national security studies, to his Kabul headquarters. They flew around Afghanistan for 3 weeks of interviews and fact-finding. Stone's alarming prison study folded into their research. Following a model Petraeus pioneered in Iraq, McChrystal also invited sympathetic think tank specialists to Kabul to kibitz about the study. It was a way to take outside advice, but also to implant McChrystal's ideas with influential op-ed writers whose work might shape American public opinion. McChrystal's effort constituted the third review of American strategy in the war in less than 12 months. As with the previous two, it suffered from a lack of clarity about the plausibility of counterinsurgency doctrine in Afghanistan. McChrystal was not necessarily advocating for a big war in Afghanistan. He was assessing the mission he had been given, in the form of the Rydell Review. McChrystal knew he could not defeat the Taliban with the troops available, although it was not clear at this point whether that was truly America's objective. Taking into account the typical requirements of counterinsurgency, it would be impossible to provide enough capable troops, international and Afghan, to secure the entire Afghan population anytime soon. McChrystal solved this by identifying 80 key terrain districts out of the 400 administrative districts in Afghanistan. These included many with urban populations in the south and east. There were an additional 41 areas of interest. Most of the territory in question lay in Helmand and Kandahar, as well as around Kabul and along the Pakistan border. The districts constituted a map of ink spots that might be secured and then linked together gradually through governance, aid, and security. Within this map, the United States would now resource a new counterinsurgency campaign of a classical clear, hold, build, transfer type. The 80 key terrain district formulation, once accepted by the Pentagon and the White House, soon became an overdetermined engineering diagram. The plan birthed a jargon-filled language of acronyms and district stability frameworks. Pentagon briefers would exclaim slogans such as, "It's great to make sure the population is attached to the government." The plan also suffered from the decision made before McChrystal's arrival to deploy the Marines to Helmand. The entire province held just 4% of Afghanistan's population, yet it contained half a dozen key terrain districts that would absorb a large share of the new American military resources. The Marines were in Helmand by order of McChrystal's predecessor, and largely because their generals had demanded independence, or, as one of McChrystal's aides put it, "We need our own science project." The Marines were not even under McChrystal's command at this point. They reported directly to Marine leadership at Central Command in Tampa, Florida. The problem of fractured command identified in the last Bush administration review remained almost a year later. At least the key terrain districts formulation solved the counterinsurgency math problem. By reducing the geographical scope of the campaign, enough American, NATO, and Afghan troops might be identified to carry it out, in rough line with traditional troop-to-population ratios. What the plan could not solve was the absence of an Afghan government capable of receiving the transfer of security and governance once NATO cleared, held, and built. Afghan capacity is an illusion. Sherrard Cooper Coles, the British envoy with 2 years of hard experience in Kabul, told Richard Holbrooke bluntly during a July 2009 meeting. The entire sequence of hold, build, transfer was based on wishful thinking. "Mr. President," Lute advised Obama during this same period, "you can send a battalion of U.S. Marines not only anywhere in Afghanistan, but literally anywhere in the world, and they will clear an area. Anywhere in South Central Asia, a battalion of Marines is going to be so tactically dominant that they can clear that area. And as long as you are willing to keep them there, they can hold it. The problem is handing the cleared area to the Afghans and doing something with it. McChrystal and Flynn and their allies had two ideas about how to prove the doubters wrong. One was to attack corruption in Afghanistan and promote good governance. Their other idea was less conventional. McChrystal would listen to Hamid Karzai's advice and make a concerted effort to reduce civilian Afghan casualties in the war, to try to make the American military presence more welcome and sustainable. "What is it that we don't understand?" McChrystal asked colleagues at ISAF that summer. "We're going to lose this fucking war if we don't stop killing civilians." As a career door-kicker, McChrystal had the credibility to promote what he called courageous restraint in Afghanistan, even if it occasionally meant walking away from a firefight with the enemy. He hosted dinners with Afghan human rights advocates and European civil society groups to listen to their ideas about how to find a better balance between the use of force and the protection of civilians. Yet McChrystal endured grumbling and skepticism from the start within his own ISAF command, particularly from the Marines. Their doctrine emphasized merciless combat. They worried that the Taliban would exploit any new tactical rules promoting battlefield restraint. It was doubtful that there was a form of just violent enough warfare carried out by foreign armies and air forces that could inspire confidence among beleaguered rural Afghan Pashtuns. On August 30th, McChrystal submitted his commander's initial assessment to Gates. An unclassified version of the report ran 66 pages. "Many indicators suggest the overall situation is deteriorating," the commander acknowledged. "We face not only a resilient and growing insurgency, there is also a crisis of confidence among Afghans. A new strategy was now required, one that would rapidly train Afghan forces to take the lead from NATO, while foreign forces, during the transition, carried out classic counterinsurgency operations in which our objective must be the population." "Success is achievable," McChrystal assured his superiors. "It would require recognizing civilian casualties as a strategic issue, addressing Flynn's insights about the failures of intelligence, and refusing to accept any longer abuse of power, corruption, or marginalization." Karzai warmed to McChrystal that summer, even as he raged at Holbrooke over the envoy's scheming to dump him. Yet as McChrystal sent his analysis to Washington, he discovered that Hamid Karzai's vision of the Afghan war was fundamentally at odds with the precepts of McChrystal's campaign plan. During the last week of August, McChrystal, Greg Vogel, Ambassador Carl Eikenberry, and a few of their aides arrived at the Arg Palace to brief Karzai on McChrystal's completed assessment of the war. They assembled around a table in Karzai's small conference room next to the main cabinet room. McChrystal had distilled his study of the war into about 20 PowerPoint slides. He presented them for about 90 minutes. Eikenberry watched Karzai. At first, the president's facial expression suggested that he might be thinking, "Why don't I have a staff that puts up slides that look this good?" The president took out a notebook and started scribbling. "Mr. President, do you have any questions?" McChrystal asked at last. "Two, General. You say the situation is bad and getting worse. I disagree. You say the situation is dire. Are you going to make the briefing public?" McChrystal said he was, in summary form. "We have to think about this," Karzai continued. "We don't want the Afghan public to panic. Is there another word for dire?" This inaugurated a search for euphemisms. Karzai went on to a more fundamental observation. "You call this an insurgency," he said. "This is not an insurgency. An insurgency, as I understand the meaning, suggests there are citizens of a country who are fighting against their government because they think the government is illegitimate. Now, we are a conservative, simple Muslim people. If they are fighting against an illegitimate government, then who are you, the United States? You are propping up an illegitimate government. No. There is no insurgency. There is a problem of international terrorism. We are allies in a battle against international terrorism. Karzai believed, like many other Afghans, that the true story of the war, the essential problem, was not his own legitimacy, but the mysterious unwillingness of the United States to challenge ISI in Pakistan. Karzai did not seem to see himself as Afghanistan's commander-in-chief. He eschewed the martial symbols of a wartime head of state. He didn't seem sure that the Taliban and other fellow Afghans his security forces fought were truly enemies. They were merely the misguided hired hands of Pakistan. Perhaps the boldest of McChrystal's promises in his commander's initial assessment concerned Pakistan. The report's key sentence was convoluted. While the existence of safe havens in Pakistan does not guarantee ISAF failure, Afghanistan does require Pakistani cooperation. Essentially, McChrystal asserted that the United States could achieve its goals even if the ISI continued to provide the Taliban sanctuary. Karzai believed that Pakistan should be the main effort of the American war. As Eikenberry once put it to him, if you had a choice about where to deploy 30,000 new American troops, you would put 5,000 into training Afghan forces, 5,000 along the border with Pakistan, and 20,000 in the federally administered tribal areas inside Pakistan. That's exactly the point, Karzai answered. You're fighting a second-best strategy. You're fighting Taliban foot soldiers in Afghanistan and destabilizing the country. You can't play the game of saying Pakistan is your ally and telling me in private that they're not. For his part, Eikenberry doubted that McChrystal's strategy could succeed. Along with Doug Lute and Joe Biden at the White House, he was a well-placed and increasingly vocal skeptic of the premises of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. Among other things, the ambassador agreed with the CIA's Vogel and Wood that the Taliban insurgency could not be defeated unless the movement's sanctuary in Pakistan was eliminated or at least badly disrupted. Immediately after the meeting with Karzai in late August, Eikenberry wrote a series of three highly classified cables laying out his concerns. They were pursuing a war strategy that Karzai did not endorse. Unlike a later cable Eikenberry wrote that fall containing similar analysis, this one did not leak. McChrystal's war strategy was premised on Karzai's reliability, but the ambassador worried that Karzai's growing waywardness did not seem to be registering with Obama's cabinet and White House advisors. He tried to address this by inviting note-takers to his meetings with the Afghan president. Eikenberry instructed the aides to write down Karzai's extemporaneous remarks verbatim. Then he ensured that the classified cables contained long paragraphs of Karzai's raw speech. He hoped it would shock Washington into recognition. He certainly got McChrystal's attention. The commanding general reacted furiously to Eikenberry's analysis and took the criticism personally. But Eikenberry and colleagues at the embassy felt the military wasn't taking their views seriously. Karzai was playing the Americans by always scheduling separate one-on-one meetings with the ambassador, Greg Vogel, and McChrystal. One view at the highest levels of the U.S. embassy in Kabul by summer's end was that Karzai was a very clever madman. Just because he was insane doesn't mean he was stupid. Every Monday at 5 p.m., Holbrooke assembled 5 dozen or so aides and outsiders at a Shura meeting in Hillary Clinton's principal conference room at the State Department. The purpose was to drive policy execution about Afghanistan and Pakistan across the government. On other days, Holbrooke ran smaller Shuras to discuss sensitive subjects. Senator John Kerry attended one Wednesday that summer and asked Frank Archibald, the CIA liaison to Holbrooke's office, about the HUMINT situation in Afghanistan, meaning human intelligence collection. Archibald said the Kabul station was good on counterterrorism, palace and electoral politics, and was working on Iran's activity in the country. An increased number of analysts and officers were now looking at the Taliban, Archibald added. Mike Flynn wanted 360-degree intelligence collection about Afghanistan society and economy, from sub-tribal loyalties to details of graft networks that alienated the public. Holbrooke was curious about all that, too, but he was more interested in finding deeper insights into the Taliban's leadership. Like Flynn, Holbrooke could see that battlefield intelligence produced reams of information about Taliban commanders and tactics, but hardly any insight about the movement's Pakistan-based leaders or their political and military strategy. Pakistan was no help on this score. Its army officers continued to inform American counterparts that autumn that the Quetta Shura is a fiction, as one Pakistani brigadier put it, nothing more than an unsubstantiated fabrication. Unfortunately, the United States had fallen victim to rumors that the Taliban's leaders had a base in Pakistan, the brigadier said. Holbrooke chuckled at the denials, but noted that, on analysis, what they really deny is the word Quetta. That was a fair point, because many Taliban leaders appeared to live in Karachi, where they were harder to trace. Pakistani generals had been lying to American counterparts about their support for the Taliban since the movement's birth in 1994. It was evidently a hard habit to break. It was not until they received McChrystal's dire assessment of the war that Lute and other aides to Obama understood that their field commander and Petraeus intended to recommend that tens of thousands more American troops be dispatched to Afghanistan to carry out the key terrain districts counterinsurgency strategy. Until then, the White House had thought the troops Obama ordered forward in February and March were all that would be required. At the time of the Rydell review in April, neither Gates nor Petraeus had said they would be looking for more soldiers. Petraeus, however, had been careful to make no promises. Informally, McChrystal now let the White House know that he might request up to 80,000 more American troops. To Biden, Lute, and other skeptics in the White House, the news was stunning. Robert Gates, too, at the Pentagon, was surprised by the request. Amid rising mistrust among his key war advisors, Obama ordered, through Jim Jones, yet another interagency review of strategy in September to digest McChrystal's report from the field and to decide the question of more troops. Lute directed the process from his cramped office in the West Wing, 50 feet from the entrance to the Situation Room, between a men's restroom and the White House mess. He drew support from the NSC's Afghanistan-Pakistan Directorate next door in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. To prepare, Hillary Clinton convened a lengthy meeting at Foggy Bottom with her senior advisors to hash out the State Department's positions. Deputy Secretary of State James Steinberg, Deputy Secretary Jack Lew, Policy Planning Director Jake Sullivan, Holbrooke, and several of his aides joined a half-day summit. Eikenberry connected by secure video from Kabul, and Patterson from Islamabad. Almost all of them agreed that military pressure was necessary to roll back the Taliban, but they also agreed that McChrystal's plan alone was insufficient. Clinton would propose a complementary plan of regional diplomacy, including efforts to talk to and pacify the Taliban. She would push as well for a much stronger focus on the alliance with Pakistan, a new partnership, as Clinton would put it, with more civilian aid, more military aid, and training. Her draft plan was essentially a less militarized expansion of the planned Colombia-inspired strategy for Pakistan conceived by the Bush administration in its final years. On September 30th, Obama presided over the first formal war strategy review session in the Situation Room. The president declared at the outset that the United States would not abandon Afghanistan. Peter Lavoie, now running analysis in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, presented an intelligence briefing derived in part from the CIA's updated district assessments maps. The Taliban controlled or contested between one-fourth and one-third of Afghan territory, and controlled or influenced about a third of the Afghan population, Lavoie estimated. The intelligence community's best judgment was that there was no chance the Taliban could take over all of Afghanistan anytime soon, but the guerrillas could gain enough influence in Kandahar, the Taliban's birthplace, to establish a refuge and create strong new momentum for their insurgency. Lavoie tried to lead the principals and their key deputies, Obama, Biden, Clinton, Gates, James Jones, Panetta, Mullen, UN Ambassador Susan Rice, Holbrooke, Loot, and others, along with Petraeus and McChrystal from Central Command, through a kind of seminar. At its heart lay the problem of war aims. The purpose of the war in Afghanistan was to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat al-Qaeda and its affiliates. But what did this stated resolve about affiliates imply exactly, about the war against the Taliban? The Pentagon presented a PowerPoint slide displaying numerous American statements and policy declarations over the years showing that, whether they wanted to admit it or not, United States policy had been to defeat the Taliban. That gave the group in the Situation Room pause, because they knew the goal was implausible. Gates, who had served at the CIA and the White House as the Soviet war in Afghanistan faltered, worried that it was too ambitious to try to defeat the Taliban. The movement was part of Afghanistan, he said at one point. He led the cabinet toward an agreement that, while they should continue to try to defeat al-Qaeda with the Taliban, the objective should be to degrade the movement and reverse its momentum. Several times over the next few weeks, Lavoie spread out the CIA maps and walked the group through the history and fundamentals of Islamist political violence in South Asia. He reviewed the demographics of Pashtunistan, the overlapping areas of Afghanistan and Pakistan where tribally organized Pashtuns lived. Two-thirds of Pashtuns were in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan, he reminded the group. Millions of Afghan refugees from the Soviet war had married and settled in Pakistan, some sending their sons to work in the Persian Gulf. After their rise in the 1990s, the Taliban built networks and found sympathy or support within this diaspora, from Dubai to Karachi to Quetta to Kandahar. The Taliban's sanctuary involved more than just training camps and safe houses in Baluchistan or Waziristan. They had depth. They were also not the same as al-Qaeda, Lavoie reminded them. They might have provided sanctuary to al-Qaeda, but they had not joined in the September 11th attack, and they did not promote war outside Afghanistan. The maps and Lavoie's demographic and historical briefings made plain to almost everyone, although Petraeus and McChrystal seemed to be exceptions, that there was no way to defeat the Taliban militarily, to eradicate them or force their surrender, unless the United States was prepared to invade Pakistan, an unstable nuclear weapons state. Obama ruled that out. That implied that the goals of the Afghan war had to be reduced to something less than the Taliban's full military defeat. Either that, or Pakistan's army had to finally take on the Taliban to wipe them out. Obama scrutinized the puzzle diligently. He hauled away fat briefing books to the White House residence and came back with notes indicating that he had read them carefully. He detected some of the contradictions. The briefing books reported, for example, that General Ashfaq Kayani and the Pakistan Army would take the United States seriously only if Obama showed staying power. Yet the same books reported that Kayani and his high command did not want the United States to send yet more combat troops into Afghanistan. How was this to be squared? Obama tried to focus several sessions of the review on Pakistan and India. He was frustrated that he kept getting back analysis that as long as Pakistan's strategic focus was on India, the army would never end support for the Taliban or allied groups. No one predicted that the relationship with India and Pakistan was going to improve quickly, yet no one had new ideas about how to manage that problem in Afghanistan. They all agreed that Pakistan required another huge infusion of American aid to help the country defeat its own Taliban insurgents. Ann Patterson, the ambassador in Islamabad, warned against putting too much faith in Pakistan's civilian government. Let's not fool ourselves that we have a democracy to work with in Islamabad. The United States had to work with the Pakistan army. More money would not purchase the general's love, however. We can't buy our way out on the core goal, she said. Here were more contradictions to consider, dating back to the early 1980s and the anti-Soviet jihad in Afghanistan. The United States judged Pakistan's army to be its essential partner, to be resourced above all other Pakistani institutions, yet the United States also wished for a more effective civilian government in Islamabad. As in earlier eras, Obama's advisors had convinced themselves that Kayani and Pasha were with them, at least to an adequate extent, or else, if they weren't, that the United States had no choice but to forge ahead and achieve what might be possible. Jim Jones had grown steadily convinced that ISI was not an American ally, but he reported to the principals that autumn that he also saw real progress with ISI. Biden said that when he spoke with Pasha, the ISI chief had told him, "Let's kill Mullah Omar and move on Haqqani, too." On September 28th, Kayani told Mullen over a secure telephone line that he might be willing to go after the Haqqanis. This was progress, Mullen felt. The Pakistan army was still reeling from its war against domestic insurgents. At last, Pakistan fears Mullah Omar, Biden thought. If the National Security Council had taken a ride up Connecticut Avenue to the embassy of Pakistan and had gone for a leisurely walk with the Pakistani ambassador, away from the listening devices he feared were implanted in his office by ISI, they would have heard a different analysis. Hussein Haqqani, the ambassador, was a former journalist and a persistent critic of the Pakistan army who had landed in Washington after Asif Zardari's election. One day in October, as the White House review went on, Haqqani received a visitor in his office. He handed over an old newspaper clipping about the shadow games within Pakistan's deep state. For instance, the bugging of rivals' offices in Islamabad. Haqqani pointed to the ceiling to indicate the presence of listening devices. "Pakistan's army is determined to fight the Pakistani Taliban," he said loudly, as if speaking to the microphones. Then he mouthed Kayani's name silently and patted his shoulders like a charades player trying to mime epaulettes. Haqqani silently mouthed words to make clear that Kayani would not fight the Afghan Taliban. The Obama administration had to understand that shadow games persisted. On October 8th, General McChrystal formally presented to the National Security Council three options for more American troops in Afghanistan. In the most aggressive plan, he would require about 80,000 additional soldiers. In the middle case, he would use 40,000 to secure the 80 key districts he had identified in the east and south. At the low end, in a plan put forward by Joint Chiefs Vice Chairman James Cartwright, he could try to deploy about 10,000 to resource fewer key districts, although the chances of success would be lower. From then on, the strategy review often devolved into discussions about troop deployments, critical districts, and numbers. Holbrooke raged privately at McChrystal's Goldilocks-inspired proposal, telling aides it was one of the shabbiest intellectual presentations of all time. Clinton, however, leaned toward recommending 40,000 more soldiers, the middle course. She seemed reluctant to break with the Pentagon, as she also advocated for complementary diplomacy and a civilian surge. Following on the Bush administration's late interest in accelerating Afghan reconstruction, the Obama administration pushed through $4 billion in fresh funds for the fiscal year beginning that October. Clinton seemed careful about the record she was creating at such a critical junction of war or peace decision-making. Petraeus yielded little. "We can't wait one day," he insisted at one session, urging more troops. "Without them, the war would fall into a death spiral." They all agreed that something had to be done about corruption in the Karzai government. Yet the cabinet did not examine in any depth how billions of dollars in international aid or CIA covert counterterrorism armies or the massive numbers of security and Western transport contractors flying back and forth each day between Kabul and Dubai might be incentivizing and creating corruption. "So much nonsense," Holbrook fumed. The war review meetings in the Situation Room dragged on. There were eventually 10 of them, totaling about 30 hours. By October's end, Clinton had grown frustrated by the review's drift away from diplomacy and the challenge of Pakistan. She directed Holbrook's office to produce a bound volume of every paper she had submitted to the White House that fall, as well as supplementary memos and slide decks. She said she wanted to ensure there was a record that at least her department had attempted to discuss issues other than troop numbers. An aide hand-delivered the volume to the West Wing office of Jim Jones. The White House never responded. In November, Jones flew to Pakistan bearing a letter from Obama to President Asif Zardari. Protocol required an exchange between counterparts, but the real audience for Obama's correspondence was Kayani. The letter's essence, as Holbrook summarized it, was, "We want to listen to your strategic terms for a peaceful settlement in Afghanistan. Tell us what they are." Holbrook flew to Pakistan next. He dined for 4 hours with Kayani and Pasha. They delivered the first draft of an answer. "It was all India, all the time," Holbrook recounted. "The Pakistanis see everything through the prism of India." The specifics included Kashmir, their access to water from Indian glaciers, and whether Afghanistan would be governed by the likes of Amrullah Saleh and other perceived Indian allies. Kayani's goal, Holbrook thought, was to get us to lean on the Indians, fool us a little, play us against ourselves, the usual game. Holbrook's solution was to concentrate on one issue, the fact that the Pakistanis believe that if we leave Afghanistan, the Indians are going to move in. Kayani told McChrystal privately in the midst of the autumn review that the most important issue in the Afghan war was whether there was a perception that the U.S. was winning. Without that perception, the Taliban would never give up violence or consider a political compromise. He might as well have been speaking about the ISI as well. Yet at the end of his review, Obama reached a decision that made clear that the United States did not intend to win the war in a conventional military sense. The final written documents and orders to come out of the review redefined America's objectives so as to eschew victory over the Taliban. The goal instead would be to reverse the Taliban's momentum and deny the guerrillas access to major cities and highways. Outside the key terrain districts, the goal would be merely to disrupt the Taliban and prevent Al-Qaeda from recreating a sanctuary on Afghan soil. It was explicitly not the objective of the United States to defeat the Taliban. That would be left to the Afghan National Army after the bulk of American troops began to withdraw, starting in 2011. Therefore, another key objective of American troops surging into Afghanistan would be to train and prepare the Afghans to carry on the long war to a successful conclusion, largely on their own. The Obama War Cabinet had concluded more or less by consensus that there was no purely military solution to the problem of the Taliban. The ambivalence of the president and his most senior White House advisors exacerbated the gap between them and the uniformed commanders they relied on. Obama felt fully committed to the destruction of al-Qaeda, and he supported efforts to give the Afghan government and security forces a chance to take charge. Yet Obama was simply not invested in a military mission designed to defeat the Taliban. His aide saw the Pentagon's uniformed commanders, Petraeus above all, as hubristic about what they had accomplished in Iraq and unrealistic about Afghanistan. Every time the generals would brief him in detail about how counterinsurgency would work step by step in Afghanistan, Obama would become more skeptical, particularly about the amount of resources that would be required to make sustainable progress. Petraeus's view was, "I'm the only one in this room who has been to war. What do you want to do? Quit? We have a mission. What are your ideas to achieve it?" The more the back and forth went on, the more Petraeus and his command came to see Obama and his aides as indecisive, naysayers, carpers from the sidelines, with no constructive alternatives to the war they were charged to fight. In late November, Obama made an additional decision. He would announce in advance that American troops would start to withdraw in 2011. It was odd on its face for a president to order American soldiers into harm's way for an urgent national security cause, while simultaneously naming a date when those interests would be achieved sufficiently for the troops to start to go home. Obama's rationale was twofold. He wanted to force the Afghans into recognition that they had to prepare quickly to take responsibility for the war against the Taliban and for successful governance. He also wanted to ensure that the generals could not maneuver the White House into extensions of time or further increases in troop numbers. The United States remained in the grip of its worst economic crisis since the 1930s. Democrats in Congress were increasingly restive about the Afghan war. Obama derived the 2011 date from the Pentagon's own internal documents, which stated that adequate progress should unfold by then if a troop surge was approved. Gates, too, had advised that if the surge of troops was not making progress by mid-2011, 2 years after the first Marines went in, then that would be a good indicator that the plan was not working. Obama decided to bind the military to its own predictions. The problem with announcing a withdrawal date was the effect it would have on Kayani and his corps commanders. They already believed that the American project in Afghanistan was destined for failure, and that its collapse might saddle Pakistan with yet another wave of turmoil. By making clear that the United States was going home, Obama would affirm the ISI's convictions and redouble the service's incentive to aid the Taliban as a means of Pakistani influence in post-American Afghanistan. Obama chose to keep his own counsel on his decision to announce a date for the start of withdrawal. At the final review session in the Situation Room on November 23rd, the subject never arose. The main question remained how many more troops to dispatch. The range of proposals on the table had by now narrowed to between 20,000 and 40,000. On Sunday, November 29th, Obama held a secure video conference with Eikenberry and McChrystal. They sat in Kabul, in the U.S. Embassy's classified conference room, as Obama's face appeared alone on a flat-screen monitor. The feeling was strangely intimate, as McChrystal put it. Obama explained that he had decided to send 30,000 more American troops to the war. His administration would also try to round up as many as 10,000 more from NATO allies to come closer to McChrystal's 40,000 troop option. Obama now also disclosed his intention to announce publicly that American troops would start heading home in July 2011. McChrystal told him that such an announcement would give the Taliban the sense that if they survived until that date, they could prevail, and it might decrease confidence among Afghan allies. Obama asked McChrystal point-blank if he could live with the decision as outlined. McChrystal said yes. He wrote later that if he had felt that an announcement of a withdrawal date would have been fatal to the success of our mission, I'd have said so. At around 5 p.m. that same afternoon in Washington, Obama summoned Gates, Mullen, Petraeus, Biden, Lute, and a few others to the Oval Office. He handed out draft orders. He said his strategy did not constitute fully resourced counterinsurgency or open-ended nation-building. He asked each of them directly if they could carry out the strategy as described, including his intention to announce July 2011 as the start of a withdrawal. Petraeus was stunned by the figure of just 30,000 more troops. It seemed to him to have been plucked from thin air. They all said yes. Petraeus thought it was not a choice. It was either take the 30,000 or nothing at all. Obama told his advisers, "I think I have to do this," because the war was deteriorating so badly that if he didn't do something to at least create some space, this whole thing could collapse. The troop surge was a holding mission necessary to allow the counterterrorism mission, drone strikes primarily, to decimate Al-Qaeda and to give Afghan security forces a chance to succeed. The Pentagon's commanders had bigger ideas. They had been trained at West Point and elsewhere to win large conventional wars, not manage expeditionary counterterrorism missions rife with contradictions and subtleties. They also knew that fighting wars successfully required confidence, momentum, sacrifice, and ambition, a rallying cause. They chafed at constraints. The next day, Obama spoke to Karzai by secure video. Karzai's inauguration to a second term as president had lately reduced his state of aggravation. He had won power for 5 more years. As a practical matter, he needed the United States to survive, however distasteful and irritating that dependency might be to him. He now told Obama he was ready to publicly support the American troop surge, or at least, this was how Obama's aides understood him. He repeated once more, however, according to a contemporary record, that the military and political dimensions of achieving peace in Afghanistan can't be addressed unless the issue of sanctuary in Pakistan is made explicit and is a priority in the new strategy. Years later, Karzai would ascribe a different emphasis to his views about the Obama troop increase. His goal, he recalled, was to reduce the American military footprint, garrison the American troops on bases, and ensure that there were no troops in our villages or towns. In any event, he was out of sync with Washington. The counterinsurgency doctrine Obama had partially endorsed turned on pushing troops into villages, towns, and urban neighborhoods. McChrystal flew that day to Rawalpindi to brief Kayani on Obama's decisions. The Pakistani general said once more that the United States lacked the time to accomplish all that was necessary. Kayani also said again that he did not think the United States could build up effective Afghan security forces to carry on the fight against the Taliban after NATO departed. McChrystal left thinking that our chances were better than he believed. On December 1st, on primetime television, Obama delivered a solemn speech at West Point. He announced, "As Commander-in-Chief, I have determined that it is in our vital interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan." In the very next sentence, without any prologue or clarification, he added, "After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home." He spent the next several minutes emphasizing how agonizing his choices had been. Obama's going-in-while-going-out decision reflected his temperamental search for middle ground and consensus, his reading of domestic politics, and his painstaking study of the Pentagon's claims and plans for the war, about which he retained skepticism. "He made an amazing decision," Holbrooke explained to a visitor soon afterward, "to send 30,000 troops and announced the withdrawals would start in 18 months? No one's ever done something like that. In Holbrooke's judgment, the Taliban was not the audience. The primary audience was the American public and the Congress. The secondary audience was the Afghans, to tell them they had to really focus on Afghan National Security Force training. The more complicated audience was the rest of the world, starting with the Pakistanis and the Iranians, who were, of course, thoroughly befuddled. It was, all things considered, the best course to take. A very interesting idea. So far as I can tell, it came directly from the president. In Kabul, on the morning after the West Point address, in the classified command center of ISAF, McChrystal spoke to his high command. He sat in a secure briefing room filled with screens showing the faces of regional commanders around Afghanistan. Other generals and colonels sat with him around tables set as a hollow square. "I think we're at an inflection point," McChrystal declared. "We have a new clarity in our mission." That mission was to provide our Afghan partners time, space, and resources to defeat the Taliban eventually. "The success of this operation will be determined by the minds of the Afghan people," McChrystal added. "It's a war to give people a chance." Part 4. The End of Illusion, 2010 to 2014. Chapter 23. The One-Man CIA. During the first week of August 2009, while on vacation in the south of France, Barney Rubin, took a call from a Saudi lawyer he had met. His contact occasionally did odd jobs for Saudi intelligence. The Saudi said that Rubin should travel to Dubai. Rubin was a political scientist with a doctoral degree from the University of Chicago, who specialized in Afghanistan as well as conflict prevention and resolution. He now worked at the State Department as a senior advisor to Richard Holbrooke. Rubin called Holbrooke and asked what he should do. "By all means go," Holbrooke said. "Just don't tell anyone what you are doing." Rubin drove to Nice and flew to Dubai, arriving in the early hours of August 9th. He took a cab to a comfortable hotel. His contact received him in his rooms a few hours before dawn. Rubin, then 59, was a stout man with thinning white hair and a bushy white beard. He had an alarming physical resemblance to Leon Trotsky, Holbrooke once noted, which was not a big asset at the Pentagon or the CIA. Holbrooke valued him because he offered a level of intellectual quality you almost never see in the U.S. government. Rubin had been traveling through Saudi Arabia and the smaller Gulf states for many years while going in and out of Afghanistan and Pakistan. The leading South Asia specialists in the U.S. intelligence community generally acknowledged that Rubin was the premier scholarly American expert on Afghan politics. He spoke Dari haltingly, as well as Hindi and Urdu, and had studied literary Arabic. As an undergraduate at Yale, he had majored in history and joined the Students for a Democratic Society, a leftist youth movement involved in the civil rights movement and the opposition to the Vietnam War. During the 1980s, as an assistant professor at Yale, he had been drawn to human rights issues in Afghanistan during the Soviet occupation. This led him to write an influential book, The Fragmentation of Afghanistan, about Afghan elites and the modern Afghan state. He was a liberal with a strong interest in peacemaking, an outlook that was in the mainstream on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where he lived. He had gotten to know his Saudi friend recently while trying to probe for Holbrooke the possibilities for dialogue between the United States and the Taliban. His contact had fought in the anti-Soviet jihad of the 1980s as a volunteer, aligned at the time with Saudi and American policy. He had known Osama bin Laden. Later, he gave up war and became a professional in the kingdom. Because of his credibility with Islamists, Prince Mukreen bin Abdulaziz, the head of Saudi intelligence since 2005, had asked him to play a liaison role between Saudi Arabia and the Taliban.